Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. Once again, I've had a last-minute cancellation, which is always kind of fun because it gives me an opportunity to talk with you, connect with you, and let you know what's going on in my mind this week. Some of you know I have a lifestyle that promotes a one-pointed focus on yoga therapy. And the definition of yoga is Chittavritti Nirodha, according to Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. So that basically means one-pointed focus. So I'm thinking it, I'm eating, I'm sleeping. There's never a moment that these beautiful teachings aren't flying around in my mind. And sometimes I'm even having conversations with some of you on Facebook or some other social media, which seems like a strange place to have such deep conversations, but we don't all have people in our neighborhoods. We don't have neighbors and friends in our towns that want to have these kind of deep philosophical, heartfelt discussions with one another. So sometimes the only people we can find are those from all over the world. And we are a community coming together as seekers on this path of yoga. So I welcome you into this discussion too that I've been having with some friends on Facebook. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. I'm Amy Wheeler, your host. Are you needing to earn some continuing education units? Well, we have the exact thing for you. Every single Monday night, we have a Monday night clinic where we practice postures, breathing, and meditation towards a very specific theme of the month. And then we stay afterwards and we talk about the theory of why we chose what we did for that particular practice. We give you a completion certificate, which you can turn into your continuing education body. And we're growing all the time. We have a wonderful community. You can do this live with us online, or you can do it through a recording. Go to www.theoptimalstate.com and check out the Monday Night Clinic, and we would love to see you there. So where do I want to start? All right, the start is a little bit of my story, how I came to yoga, who I was before I came to yoga, and then how do we go forward together, honoring the teachings of yoga, honoring the source culture, honoring Indian philosophy and even Hinduism as a culture, as well as a religion? And how do we move forward together, having cultural appreciation without cultural appropriation, and yet serve the modern people who need yoga therapy and who benefit from yoga therapy? So this might be a delicate discussion. It can be ongoing. Things are always changing and evolving. And if you hear this a year after it's recorded, we may all have completely different opinions. This is just a moment in time to talk about a very tiny aspect of yoga and yoga therapy. So let's get started. So my history is that I was born to a family that my father was a Lutheran minister, which is one of the forms of Christianity. We're probably like the Cinderella of Christianity. We broke away and became a little bit more liberal than some of the other churches out there. And, you know, in Lutheranism, we were founded by Martin Luther. It's really about grace, meaning you are loved by God, by Jesus, if you want. And there's nothing you can do to mess that up. Like, it isn't earned. You just are. You are loved. And that's the bottom line. And even if you did horrible things in this life, it doesn't detract from that grace. And to me, when I started learning Indian philosophy, I was kind of like, oh, that to me, you know, sounds like some of the things I'm learning in yoga, not necessarily the love component, but as I dig into this, you'll see some of the connections. Another thing is in Lutheranism, according to my father, not everybody agrees with this, but basically says there's no heaven and there's no hell. Like, your heaven and your hell is what you make it here on earth, that we don't really talk too much about the afterlife, and that what comes after you are gone is the connections you made in this life, how you impacted people, kind of the ripple effect of your presence while you were here will continue on through the people you loved and cared for and took care of. As you pass away, there will still be ripple effect of your actions while you were here. And I think that also has some nice similarities to Indian philosophy. And, the other thing is, because there's grace and we can't do anything not to have that grace, there's like no punishment. You're not like a horrible person and you're going to be punished in Lutheranism. So I just wanted to put that out there because, when you say, oh, I'm a Lutheran or I'm a Catholic, or, some people may have never heard of Lutheranism before. And that's why I think Lutheranism is considered such a progressive religion, if you will, because it's all about taking care of the poor, taking care of those who are hungry, those who maybe have not been provided for in this life or have been hurt. It's kind of like karma yoga, like we're here to be of service to others. So that's kind of the context of what I grew up in. And because my dad was a minister, after school each day at my little Lutheran church school, I would go across the street and I'd play in the church in the parish hall from pretty much like 3 o'clock p.m. until we went home for dinner. And the secretaries would help me with my homework and I'd play basketball and go sneak into the church and the sacristy. I think that's what it's called. I can't remember now. And, I'd sneak those little wafers. Dad, if you're listening, I don't know if you knew all this. I didn't take any wine. I knew better than that. But the point is, I had a pretty strong upbringing in our little Christian school. Every Wednesday, we would have to go to church during school hours. And then on the weekends, of course, we went on Sunday. Most of the time, because my dad was up there preaching, I thought I was so smart. I would go sit for about 10 or 15 minutes in the back of the church thinking, oh, he'll see me here. And then I would like sneak away and go play basketball and things. Somehow in my little mind, I didn't realize he was going to see me leave too. But so I'm not saying I was like some great kid. I had my things, but in general, it was a very strong Christian upbringing. And I don't feel traumatized by it. I felt supported. I felt loved. I felt the people were actually doing the work of taking care of each other. I didn't feel there was a lot of judgment. I didn't feel that anyone was excluded. It was very, very open to all types of people without judgment, and still is, by the way, one of the first churches to allow women to become ministers, which is wonderful. And then also one of the first churches to allow LGBTQIA plus people to be ministers and, all the things. So, with that said, even with all those benefits, when I got into college, I really became interested in all world religions. And maybe this is why people don't like universities, some people, I should say, because you get exposed to like your first college class where you spend 4 weeks on Hinduism and 4 weeks on Buddhism and 4 weeks on this religion, Jainism, and 4 weeks on Taoism. And you start to see the similarities and that there's many, many paths to the mountaintop. So in college, when I was introduced to that idea that it's not just one type of people get to go to the mountaintop and they're saved and everybody else is doomed, at a pretty young age, started to understand like, oh, it's just the culture that you're brought up in. It's not that any one of them is wrong. It's that we all are born into something that, we might be educated in, or maybe we're not born into a family or a society or a community that values religion at all. Maybe your family was agnostic. Maybe your family was atheist and very scientific. And all of those were accepted within our family. Even to this day, with all the kids we have in our family, we have a very, very wide variety of belief systems. Nobody has really stayed strictly Lutheran. We have plurality in our family, shall I say. So, anyway, when I went to college and I saw all these different religions and non-religions and even paganism leading to the same place. And then I taught at a college for 25 years and had some philosophy classes that I taught. And same thing, we could see all these different similarities between the different philosophies of life. And so when I came to yoga, I think I was around 30 years old, maybe late 20s, early 30s. And it was like this aha moment when I started learning the deeper teachings and technologies and advanced structure of yoga through the Bhagavad Gita, Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. I was blown away. I was like, wow, they have been able to systematize. And when I say they, I mean the Indian people on the Indian subcontinent. Like at that time, I didn't consider myself part of the community, but I could see, like, wow, this has been systematized over thousands and thousands of years. This is way more advanced than anything I had ever seen. And I think Buddhism has some very similar structures that there's almost like a ladder, there's a system that you can go through, and you can kind of see how it's laid out. And not that you want to, look at where you are on the ladder, but you technically could. You could be like, oh, here's about where I am. And I had never seen or heard anything like that before. And of course, I fell in love with it. And only to learn that don't look at where you're on the ladder. It doesn't matter. That's going to ruin you. But that is just to say that the depth of the teachings and the structure of Indian philosophy, and specifically yoga philosophy, for me was just mind blowing and continues to be mind blowing, by the way. And so here I am at, mid 50s, considering myself a Lutheran Buddhist yogi, yoga person, and believing that all three have value and that I don't actually have to choose between any of them. I need to learn to honor all of them and basically come to the understanding that as much as I study any of them, I'm never going to know it all. I'm never going to be an expert. I'm a seeker, and that's okay. So this brings me to the line of cultural appreciation versus cultural appropriation. And basically, how is it that a lot of us, and I don't want to say white people, I don't want to see Westerners, because frankly, I see it in people of all colors, and I see it in people living on all continents, having a colonialist mindset, meaning we're going to come in and we're going to take what we need and we're going to parse it apart, divide it up, sell the parts that we think are saleable, make money off it, and leave the culture behind. So I don't think that is actually specific to just Westerners or to people with light skin. I see it in a lot of people, and that's not to say that it's okay. That's not to dismiss that what we are all participating in. It's just to say it's almost become the norm. And so to kind of say, wow, what can we as a community do about this? How can we learn about this? How can we grow together in this area? What are some of the things that we might want to put in place as ethical framework to help us move forward together in a way that we are practicing cultural appreciation? That's where I think we are. And I think a lot of people are on board with that. We want to learn more. We want to honor and not just take what is not ours, has never been ours, will never be ours, and pull it apart into its most valuable parts and try to sell it. I mean, I think that's really the bottom line. And so I've been having these discussions on Facebook about who should teach yoga, who's allowed to teach yoga, who's allowed to teach yoga in what ways. Do you have to have a certain level of expertise with Indian philosophy in order to be able to be a yoga teacher or a yoga therapist? And where are those lines? And, the truth is, those are huge questions to be answered by our community. And I think as long as we are aware of those questions and we're struggling with them and we're connecting together over those questions, I think that's enough. We don't have to have the answers. And I would actually be a little leery or wary of anyone who says they do have all those answers, because any one of us has a very limited perspective in our little tiny body, mind, spirit container. And we all have biases and we're all pretty self-serving. And, we have been impacted by this colonial mindset. So I think it's more about the journey together and trying to talk through it and be with it rather than saying we have to find an answer for the community and then we're going to write it down and, you know, frame it on the wall. And I think that actually goes in alignment with what we know in yoga to be true, that it's an active living tradition that is always changing. It has these deep roots down into the ground, but it's also changing and it's serving the people who are right in front of us at any given time. So this brings us to the question that, you know, we were kind of discussing on Facebook. Do you have to be a Hindu? Do you have to have Hindu religion to be a good yoga teacher? If you're not, should you not even be teaching yoga? How much of Hinduism needs to be in our yoga teaching? If you have someone with who knows what that's come to you for yoga therapy, as the patient or the client, do they need to know all about Hinduism? Do they need to know the entire structure or technology of Indian philosophy? And what are all the steps to get enlightenment? Or can we actually look at some of the basics and then translate them to share with our clients? And what I mean by that is we as a teacher have studied deeply. Because we are always a student. We will always be studying. There's like no end game here. So that's number one. Have we actually looked at the wholeness of yoga and not just the parts that are popular and saleable? So have we taken the breath work and the asana and just went off with it? Or have we learned all about mantra, mudra, nyasam, the different texts, the Bhagavad Gita, as I said, Patanjali's Yoga Sutra? Have we really immersed ourselves in that as teachers, even though we may not choose to interface with our general public with Sanskrit, or maybe we are choosing to meet the person where they are? And I think this is where the rub comes in. This is where people say, no, you cannot just take the English words and use them to help the person in front of you. And I'm probably going to get some flack for this, but I listen to my teachers of 25 years, and they tell me in the yoga therapy context, which is health, healing, and beyond, doesn't mean everybody's going to try to go for liberation or samadhi or kaivalyam, any of those altered, you know, high-level states of consciousness. They simply want to feel better because they have a little bit of anxiety, or they don't understand why they feel guilty, or they have a little bit of tightness across their chest, right? So the idea here is, yes, we as teachers and yoga therapists need to have studied deeply the wholeness of yoga, and we need to continue to study. But through that immersion, we are then going to be able to choose the correct tools in a very precise way for the person in front of us. It's not that I only have two tools. I don't have the postures and the breath work, and that's all I needed. I didn't need the rest. You don't know you didn't need the rest, right? So the idea is that you would try to get as much of the whole toolbox as you can within the limits of your life. And that's a whole nother discussion, right? But knowing the whole toolbox so that you can choose the correct tools for the right person is the key. I think that's maybe what is upsetting a lot of us, is that if you only want to learn the four breathing techniques and the 30 asana and then use that to go out and make money, that can be upsetting to people. So number one, could we agree as a community that this is a lifelong study and that we are immersing ourselves in all the limbs of yoga and that we will continue to long-term, that it's a journey for each of us? And, you know, so that might be kind of a starting place or a place that if we could agree to that, then we have the ability to connect and have a deeper conversation.
My name is Amy Wheeler. I'm the host of the Yoga Therapy Hour, but also the creator of a mobile app that's based on the gunas of yoga and Ayurveda. It's the first of a kind, and we'd love for you to try it for free. The app is called The Optimal State, and it tracks the state of your gunas, and then it gives you therapeutic interventions. Now we're starting to add Dharma Talks, as well as yoga nidra. And we think these are wonderful ways that you can do some self-care and take care of yourself on a regular basis. So come join us, the Optimal State app. We'd love to see you over there too.
So the next kind of thing or thread I saw on Facebook that I was watching a conversation and I eventually got myself into was, do you need to be Hindu in order to pass on the teachings? And is it possible to be a Christian? Is it possible to be a Buddhist? Is it possible to be anything really, a Taoist, and still be a yoga therapist? Because I'm mainly interested in yoga therapy. You know, I can't speak for the whole world of yoga, but let's just say as a yoga therapist. And people were having pretty heated discussions like, no, you cannot do that. You have to immerse yourself in Hinduism. You cannot cherry pick. It's not okay. That's cultural appropriation. And then other people were like, no, wait a minute. I've been XYZ my whole life. I have studied yoga deeply for decades. You can't tell me I cannot use this to help people in the world. There's so many people needing help right now. The world is such a mess. Are we really going to, you know, basically put the walls up and say, you can't use yoga unless you subscribe to Hinduism? So that was kind of the discussion that was going on, all the way to, could you be a Christian and be a yoga therapist? Could you be a Buddhist and be a yoga therapist? And some people would say, no, you can't, because those are not from Indian philosophy. Well, Buddhism is, but you get the idea that you can't just cherry pick and mishmash whatever you like. So then we got into this discussion about Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, and what does Patanjali say about this? And again, all I know is what my teachers from Krishnamacharya Yogamandram tell me. I'm not an expert in Sanskrit. I don't know what the original texts say because I can't read Sanskrit with the original characters. And if I could, there's probably a whole lot more learning that needs to happen besides just learning the characters. You then need to use that knowledge to go study with masters, delving deeply into the text. So I say this with a lot of humility that there's a whole lot I don't know, but I am committed to the lifelong study and to learning. That's, I think, all we can do. So the discussion was, can you basically pop in Jesus or Buddha or Allah for Ishvara? Ishvara being kind of like the supreme entity, the supreme source of the cosmic order. Some people might call it God, but other people would just say, look, there's something that is the organizing principle of the substratum of existence. We don't have a definition for it. It doesn't really have a form like Jesus or Buddha. It just is, right? And so what I've learned is that unlike in the theistic traditions, Patanjali doesn't name or personalize what Ishvara has to be. The root of the word Ish is about abundance and kind of this all-knowing, unlimited power. So that if we connect our minds to the qualities of Ishvara, our minds begin to mirror those qualities. And that's kind of the long-term goal, is that we try to get our minds to be more like this concept of Ishvara. You may say, well, what are those qualities of Ishvara? It's in many different texts, but from the Vayu Purana, chapter 2, verse 39, and then a little bit in 215 to 219, first quality is jnana, possessing all the knowledge. So seeing the big picture. Another one is to have the highest level of detachment. Letting things be as they are, it is not for me to possess, is not for me to own, is not for me to have the I, me, my mind complex. I am doing my best, giving 100%, trying to have as much clarity, and I remain detached about the outcome. Or you remain detached, more importantly. Another one is that Ishvara has the abundance, the power, the mastery, Ishvara burns away our impurities through the heat of transformation, that Ishvara is truth in past, present, and future. And in fact, there is no time and space when it really comes down to it. Those are things that our little minds have put in a linear format, but the truth is they don't exist. That Ishvara would give us the qualities of fortitude, inner strength, acceptance, patience, forgiveness, kindness, compassion, and that Ishvara is eternal. And Ishvara has many different forms of perception, way beyond any perception that you and I could have as humans. And that there is something inside of us, the Atman, which is kind of like a little individual Ishvara inside of you that is connected to the whole, that substratum that I talked about a few minutes ago, that everything emerges from that, it manifests, and then it dissolves back into it. So there's a start, a middle, and an end to everything. So when we talk about Ishvara, we're really talking about those qualities. And so I think the natural next question is, could Jesus, could Buddha, could Allah, could anyone that we maybe connect to have those qualities? Because Ishvara is formless. It is all of it. It is everything. But then each one of our religions or beliefs or philosophical structures kind of pulls down certain qualities from Ishvara and says, oh, these are the qualities of our God or our deity or our religion. So do you see how all of the qualities exist out there as Ishvara, as that substratum? But then each one of us or our religions or our ways of being in the world kind of says, well, these are the qualities that are important to us. But the truth is, all of the qualities make up Ishvara. So, you know, one question that comes to mind is, what if I chose a religion or a philosophy of life to live by that actually wasn't those qualities that I just listed, that basically said, here's the way we have to do it. Our way is the best way. And if you don't do it our way, then you're going to hell or bad things are going to happen to you or you're not a true seeker, you know, all of those types of things. So as I'm being taught by my teachers, the bottom line is, in this body where you are right now, which is probably not very close to enlightenment, let's face it, we're all struggling, is whatever your belief system putting you closer to sattva, to a mind that is balanced, is calm, is compassionate, is wise, seeks truth, not arrogant, not hurting people, a mind that allows you to speak your truth with kindness, not be greedy or possessive. You know, if you look at even just the yamas, how we socially interact with others, like, is whatever you believe in helping you be better in those areas? Is it helping you be more calm? Or is it causing us to want to fight people and to want to compete and I'm better than you and yours is wrong and mine is right and you have to do it my way? All this rajas. Or is it causing more of a tamasic mind where you're kind of obsessed with something and, you know, you're just kind of down there in the mud and the muck and the goop? So maybe the question isn't, can we have this religion versus that religion and call that our Ishvara? Maybe the real question is looking at ourselves to determine if whatever we've chosen to believe in and grasp onto as our philosophy of life or religion or non-religion, if that's actually helping us to be a nicer, kinder, more compassionate, balanced person who has detachment and who doesn't have to try to control everything and doesn't have to fight with people, who can walk in a room and help people have understanding. Maybe they're not always going to get along. I mean, I think it's natural that we as humans kind of have some tapas and we don't want to go into the whole spiritual bypass thing and just be a people pleaser. But the question is whatever you believe in helping you to suffer less, to feel more balanced, to feel more calm, to feel more sattvic, to speak more truth in a way that people can hear and isn't attacking or competitive or telling everybody they're wrong? Does it help you to be less judgmental and still have great boundaries and know when to pull away and say, yep, that's not for me. I'm not going to participate in that. So those are some of the things that maybe we could think about is whatever you've chosen, is it helping you to feel better more of the time, take care of other people, be a nicer human, speak truth when needed, because sometimes that's needed too. And if it is, could we call that your Ishvara? No matter what label it has on it, could we say that's your equivalent of Ishvara? And then the question around cultural appropriation and appreciation comes, like, is that okay? If I find out that Lutheranism does that for me and it's working for me, and that's what I've been born with and trained with for most of my life, like, could I stay with that and still do yoga therapy? And of course, you all know my answer. My answer is 100% yes. And if someone came to me with their religion and said, I don't want to do this as part of my yoga therapy, I would totally honor that. We don't need to do that. If they came and they said, I love yoga and yoga therapy, but I'm very Catholic and I need to have Jesus with me while I do this, according to the people I study with, that is 100% not only good and fine, but we should do that. We should let them have their deepest heart connection. That's going to get them where they want to go. And it doesn't have to be an Indian deity. It doesn't have to be 100% in alignment with Hindu culture. So that's what I've been taught. But then here's the rub. Do we tell our clients where these techniques come from? That there's a whole system that is mapped out, and that actually we're using the whole system as mapped out in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, chapters 1 through 4. But instead of having an Indian god or goddess, we're letting them insert Jesus because that brings them peace, that brings them tranquility, harmony, sattvic mind. Like, does the client actually need to know that? Do they need to know the back end? Is that taking from the culture? And again, this is a community discussion. I'm just bringing up questions that we can all talk about. In my mind, if they asked me, I would 100% say, yes, this is a structural way that it has been done for thousands of years through Indian philosophy. I would not hide that. I would never go and say, oh, I'm doing Christian yoga, and pretend that somehow Christianity came up with this system and try to sell it to people. I would definitely think that's out of bounds. I think honoring the tradition where it came from and putting that on our websites and admitting, you know, where and how we've benefited from these teachings and who our teachers are and how long we've studied with them and continue to study with them, I think we absolutely have to do that. And my first meeting with my client, I don't know if I need to tell them that. That's not why they're here. They may be here because they have, as I said, anxiety or chest pain, you know, a little tightness across their chest or shoulder, you know, something like that. So I think, you know, there's no hard and fast line, but we have to ask ourselves these questions. Am I trying to hide where this came from? Or do I not even really know where this came from? Have I taken the tools that I wanted for my practice and then stopped all study and I just want to use those tools? Or I see this a ton. Am I mixing Hinduism and Buddhism without even knowing it because I haven't studied either one deeply enough to know how they are similar and how are they different? And why am I doing asana and pranayama from yoga perspective? And then boom, I jump over to Buddhism for my meditation. Like, why did I make that jump, right? Those are the kinds of things that I think we need to keep studying and trying to understand over time. And of course, we will all look back with embarrassment at all the misinformation that we gave out when we just didn't know any better. And that's why humility is so important, to always know that the more you learn, the more you're going to be like, oh my God, I didn't know. Oh, I'm so sorry to those prior students that, you know, I didn't know. So I think if we committed to this long-term connection with Indian philosophy, I think a lot of the fears and the upset around cultural appreciation and cultural appropriation, I think they would be soothed, because I think people would see that we are genuine seekers, long-term lifetime seekers, and that we're not just going into cherry pick to go make money off of it. I actually think that the world of yoga right now is going through a transformation for many, many reasons, not just because of cultural appropriation. I think the market forces out there, the oversaturation, the number of 200-hour yoga teacher trainings out there, the studios that have closed because of COVID, the current political climate, all of it is kind of like a cleansing of yoga and yoga therapy. And I know a lot of people who are wondering if they just need to maybe do something else to provide for themselves and then kind of let yoga be their lifelong study. And like I said, as a spiritual seeker, but just to say that this cleansing may not be a horrible thing. I know it feels horrible. And I can tell you, I have felt horrible about it because I want to be immersed in yoga ideas and philosophy all day, every day. I don't want to go work at a desk job somewhere with something I'm not interested in so I can do yoga for an hour a day. I get that pain. It's not easy to move in that direction, even though sometimes we have to for a period of time. And even Krishnamacharya, if you remember back for a few years, lost kind of the university position or the school position that he had and picked coffee beans for a few years before, you know, getting back on his feet and working for himself out of his home for many, many years after that. So I think it's probably pretty normal that we all have to move in and out of these challenging spaces as we are committed to the yoga journey over a long period of time. And I think that brings us back to Ishvara Pranidhana, this concept of I am committed to this journey. I will continue to seek. I will continue to immerse myself in these deep Indian philosophical studies. I will be devoted. I will be dedicated. I will allow myself to be held by the teachings. I will allow myself to be held by teachers that are, you know, obviously ethical people. I will allow myself to be held in a community that struggles and wrestles with teachings and does our best to try to figure out what they're telling us and how we can suffer less. And I will even surrender myself to this idea of a sustainable path forward, that it may not always look rosy, that I may have to do something a little different to be able to stay with my yoga, that sometimes we feel like we have to give it up all together in order to provide for ourselves. But having that faith that the yoga isn't leaving you, you're not leaving the yoga. It just may be that you have to go do something else for a little bit in order to sustain, that that's kind of a normal part of the process. But we don't have to grieve losing our connection and our seeking of this yoga path. Also knowing that we have daily sadhana, that we will be communing with our deepest self, with Ishvara that resides inside of us every single day. We can do that for free. We can do that by ourselves. We don't need anybody to help us do that. Of course, having a community and a teacher and teachings is always helpful to sustain that. But ultimately, it's a you are with you for this lifetime if you want to stay with the path of yoga. So I think that idea of surrendering to all of that is really hard. And I know for me in the last couple of years when I've been wrestling with, oh my gosh, what do I do to move forward on this path? I know for me, realizing that even if I couldn't do yoga professionally and make a living, that it doesn't mean I'm not still with yoga, that I can't still get up several mornings a week and study with my teachers on Zoom, right? And I think that's the big loss that so many people might be feeling right now as they realize that, wow, yoga as a field, yoga therapy as a field is going through this big period of transformation and tapas and heat and kind of overhaul. Where do I land in that? That grieving of not knowing where we're going to land, that professional landing is separate from where are you going to land as a human being who's seeking the path of yoga. You will have that no matter what. We really don't know what will happen professionally. And all I can say is stay with your personal practice, stay studying. I mean, with my teachers in India, it is so inexpensive to study with them a couple mornings a week. It's incredible. I mean, I think I paid $300, and it's probably going to end up being a 2-year program going over all the sutras in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra word by word. I mean, that is incredible that at this day and age, we still have access to that kind of quality instruction and teachers and community. That is nourishing and sustaining, right? So that is not going away. We all can do that. And there's so many also free online services. For a long time, I was listening to a podcast that went through every verse of the Bhagavad Gita. That was free. I mean, it's not even that we have to pay a lot of money for many of these things, but we always have that. So I guess that's kind of where I'd like to end this episode is let us continue to appreciate the source culture. Let us be continuous seekers of the wholeness of yoga. Let us do our best not to cherry-pick certain parts. Let us give credit to the source teachings whenever we can and however we can. And let us also have a little bit of grace that we can not have to lead with it every single time for every single client in yoga therapy. That if they are very Catholic and they want to chant Alleluia instead of Om Shrim Shriyai Namaha, that is goodness. That is truth. That is okay that they would insert their source culture or their source religion into the technology of yoga, that it doesn't have to be a deity or a Hindu god or a goddess. And again, I understand what I'm saying is going to upset a lot of people. And this is a discussion. Then come back and tell me why so we can continue our discussion. This isn't the end all say all. This is just saying, look, I want us to be together on this path. I want us to be working towards a more sattvic mind. I want us to understand each other and I want to connect. And here's where I am on March 27th, 2025, at noon in my thought process. And this will shift. I promise you, it will shift. And I think a lot of us are even afraid to say where we stand on this and how far we've come. I know looking back over the last 25 years, there were so many things I said and did that were so embarrassing now, and I cringe when I think of them. And I'm sure 25 years from now, I will be feeling the same about this podcast. So, anyway, just wanted to connect with you all, let you know that I see you, I feel you, I hear you out there, that people are really struggling right now, both with the cultural appropriation piece, but also the piece around can I make a living? Can I continue to do this work that I love all day, every day? And for some of us, we may not, and that's okay too. We may have to shift some things around in our life, but you will always have your daily sadhana, your daily practice to connect with. All right, everybody, have a wonderful day, and we will see you next week. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour. We are really, really blessed to have you all as listeners. We can feel the energy coming back, the gratitude, and we want you to know how much we appreciate you out there in the audience. Every little bit of goodness that we share with you from our guests goes into your ears, down into your heart. I am hopeful that it radiates out into the world. That is the goal. So thank you for being our dependable and reliable listeners. You have no idea how much we appreciate seeing those downloads every single week. Thank you for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour. We wish you a wonderful week. We hope that somehow, in a small way, we've contributed to your well-being so that you can go out and share that well-being with others. That's what life is all about, bringing in the goodness through you and then shining it out to the world. We need you more than ever. So let's all get out there, do good, be good, and have a great week.